I'm on? I'm good?
Yeah.
All right. Yep, so I'm married to Steph. We've been married 19 years. I have three young boys, Toby, Cooper and Jonty. They're age 8, 6 and 4. So it's just absolute mayhem right now. It's
outside of country leading your wife.
Yeah, yeah, so this is rest for me coming all the way here.
Okay, excellent. And how do you spend your time? Week to week, how do you
spend your time? All right, so I work 4 days a week with City Bible Forum. My main role is to give public talks at breakfast, at coffee shops, lunch times, in auditoriums, and every now and then we have these one-off nighttime events, usually in a pub. So it's like, if you're familiar with campus ministry, it's like campus ministry, but instead of a university campus, we're in the business district of Sydney, and instead of university students, now we're working with workers. And it's the same challenges, you know, it's a highly transient mobile community and people are very time poor, and how can we somehow get them in the one spot for about half an hour just to hear a talk about Jesus. And our two audiences, we're aiming at Christians to build them up with the Bible, but at the same time trying to attract non-Christians to hear about Jesus. You can go to YouTube, type in City Bible Forum, type in my name, Sam Chan, and you can see some of the talks I've been giving lately this year.
And it's hard to believe. You look like a very young man.
Yeah, I'm turning 50 this year. So it's halfway. Well, I think it's past the halfway point, isn't it?
No,
gosh.
No, yeah. How have you coped with the crisis of middle age? What have been some of
it is
crisis?
A crisis. It is. I've done a lot of reading into it. So it's a second adolescence. It's a search for identity and meaning. Usually you feel trapped by three things: your aging body, your family, and your job. And usually you lash out in one, if not all three areas, either with an irresponsible purchase or you leave your job or something or a new activity. So as you're pushing me towards, I took up Krav Maga 3 years ago and I stopped because I ruptured my biceps tendon last year. I talked to my surgeon. I work one day a week as a doctor assisting a surgeon. He said for men over 35 taking up a new activity, the rate of injury is 100%.
So maybe I shouldn't take up kitesurfing.
Don't take up anything. Stay at home.
Well, we'll look forward to hearing what you have
to say.
Sure,
thanks.
Thank you very much,
Sam. So I won't need that. I'll move this forward. Oh, it's an Israeli self-defense thing. And it's interesting, like the Asians, when they do Wing Chun and all that, it's all about the flow and chi and subtlety. You use the opponent's force against them. You know, they're stronger, you flow back, you know, you pull when they push. Krav Maga's, no, you hit first, harder than they're hitting you, and hit them repeatedly until they stop hitting you. So you meet force with force. Actually, put that here. All right, so once again, I'm Sam, and as Scott alluded, Asians cannot swim. So I remember when I was in primary school, I was the only kid in my class who could not swim. And so during swimming lessons, my teacher would just yell, "Swim!" Because she had never had a student who could not swim before, and she didn't know what to do. And I remember him signaling for help, and she just said, "Swim." And I would sink. I vomited my lunch back up in the pool once. It did laps, scaring all the other swimmers. But you can't tell a drowning person to swim, because if they could swim, they would be swimming. And it's the same with evangelism. We always tell Christians you should tell your friends about Jesus. And it just feels so disheartening, because we would be telling our friends about Jesus if we knew how. So there's no point just saying, tell your friends about Jesus. So tonight, in the next hour, I'm going to hopefully equip and empower us to tell our friends about Jesus. I'm going to share some points. They're not silver bullet answers. I'm not saying they're great ways, but they're good ways that have sort of worked for me. You might have better ways, but you might find some of these ways helpful. So they're more like tools to put in the toolkit. There's no one, do it this way and this will work, or you must do it this way, otherwise it's the wrong way. No, these are good ways that have worked. You might have better ways. You might have great ways. So I'm going to go through them one by one. I've got about five or six of these points. The first one is the longest, so don't freak out when you realize, wow, that went for half an hour. Now, the first one will go for half an hour, and the others will be a bit quicker. So point one is we need to get our friends to become their friends. Get our friends to become their friends. Point one, get our friends to become their friends. What do I mean by this? Well, imagine if I got here now and said, last night, the most amazing thing happened. this UFO landed in our backyard while my wife and I were watching TV, and this green man got out, said, "Kate, come." So we got into the UFO and he took us to his home planet, Jupiter. We got out, we walked around, and then we had dinner with his friends and family. We jumped back in the UFO, came back, and because of the space-time continuum thing, we went through a time portal and only 1 second of Earth time went by. Who here believes me? No one. What if I said, I've got an amazing story. 2,000 years ago, God sent us his son, Jesus, 100% God, 100% human at the same time, born of a virgin. And when he was an adult, he healed people. Blind people gave their sight back, raised dead people from the grave. And then he himself died. And if you believe this, your sins get taken away. And he didn't stay dead. 3 days later, he rose from the dead. He's in heaven right now. And if you believe this, his spirit will live in you. So when you die, your spirit goes to be with Jesus in heaven. And one day, depending on which denomination you belong to, he'll come back and set up a kingdom here on earth. And at that moment, your body will rise from its grave and be reunited with your soul. Who here believes me? Wow. Now, you got me thinking, why am I happy to believe the Jesus story and not the Jupiter story? Because even as I'm saying it, I'm not quite sure I believe the Jesus story myself. And you got to admit, the Jupiter story is a lot more believable than the Jesus story. Why are we happy to believe the Jesus story but not the Jupiter story? Because of what we call plausibility structures. So we have these plausibility structures. And these are predetermined, pre-programmed plausibility structures that prejudge what you hear as believable or not believable. So as I'm telling you the Jupiter story, you have these predetermined, pre-programmed plausibility structures that are prejudging what you hear. So say, last night this UFO landed in our backyard. Your plausibility structure is going, bum, 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 red light, red light, red light, implausible, implausible, implausible. And then we went to the planet Jupiter, got out, bum, 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 implausible, implausible, implausible. And we went through this space-time continuum thing, bum, 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 implausible, implausible, implausible. But as I tell you the Jesus story, your predetermined, pre-programmed plausibility structures are prejudging what you hear. Jesus, 100% God, 100% human. Bling, bling, bling. Plausible, plausible, plausible. And he died on a cross, and this would take your sins away. Bling, bling, bling. Plausible, plausible, plausible. 3 days later, he rose from the grave. Bling, bling, bling. Plausible, plausible, plausible. Why are you happy to believe this? Because your plausibility structures are green lighting the Jesus story. Where do we get these plausibility structures from that prejudge what you're hearing? We get them from three main sources. We get them from our community, people that we know and trust. We get them from our own personal experiences. And then we also get them from the facts, evidence, and data. So right now, as I'm telling you the Jupiter story, none of us belong in a community where any friends that we know or trust believe in UFOs. None of us here have had a personal experience of UFOs, and none of us here believe there are any facts, evidence, or data to support my story. But as I tell you the Jesus story, most of us here belong in a community of people that we know and trust who also believe in the Jesus story. Most of us here have had a personal experience of Jesus in our life. Most of us here believe there are enough facts, evidence, and data to support the Jesus story. Now, out of all these, rightly or wrongly, whether we like it or not, the most powerful one is community, and the least powerful one is facts, evidence, or data, whether you like this or not, rightly or wrongly. So if I said to you, you know what, the UFO is still in my backyard. It's in Sydney. It's just a 5-hour flight. It's only a $300 ticket. Who here wants to pay $300 to see the UFO? No one. Yeah, but you want to go to Sydney. All right. But let's say you don't believe the data exists, even if it's there in my backyard. And let's say you did fly to Sydney and you saw it. You touched it. you'd be going, nah, there's another explanation. This is an elaborate hoax because they don't exist. So even if you see the evidence with your own eyes, touch it, you can explain it away because you don't want to believe the story. And it's the same with the Jesus story. We keep thinking it's all about facts, evidence, and data, and it's important, but rightly or wrongly, whether we like it or not, the most powerful thing is community. Now, community is very important for determining what we believe. It's interesting. When parents have children, they play this game. We want to name our kid a name not so common, like Peter, John, or James, but not so funky, like Matthew with three T's and a silent Q. But that sweet spot just in the middle that shows, hey, we're not common, we're not weird, but we're cool, all right? So we're going to give our kid an edgy name. So one year we named one of our kids Cooper. Hey, how edgy is Cooper? And that year, Cooper was a top 10 New South Wales name. So we just do what the people around us do, whether we know it or not. We believe what people around us believe. We think like people around us think, and we do what they do. Who here believes women have a right to vote? Wow, almost everyone. That's amazing. Because there's nothing in the Bible telling us that that should be, but we're in a community that believes that. Who here thinks we have a right to free education and free health? Wow, all the uni students, all the workers, they go, I'm not so sure. But there's nothing in the Bible telling us that, but we're in a community that believes that. But if you're in America, and this is a Bible-believing church, most people are going, nah. I'm not, my hard-earned money is not paying for someone else's education. They need to earn that right themselves. Who here believes motorcyclists should wear a helmet on their head as they ride? Wow, almost everyone. If this is the USA, church, Bible-believing Christians, nah, this is my head. I've got every right to do with it what I want. Who are you to put a helmet on my head? And besides, I'm paying my own hospital bills. You're not paying it, so it's all right. Community-driven beliefs. Now, imagine you came in here, and I'm the one person who believes in UFOs. No matter how true it is, so we're talking about, what we're talking about here is the believability status of a claim, not the truth status. That's a different thing. It's the believability status we're talking about. I'm the only one here talking about UFOs in a room full of people who don't believe in it. I'm coming across as the one crazy schmuck. So it's very unbelievable, implausible. Let's say you came here tonight and this half of the room said, me too. UFO landed in our backyard last night. We too went to Jupiter last night. I thought that's you I saw, just wasn't sure. Didn't want to wave, just in case. Now this half of the room, how are you feeling? You think, huh? There might be something to this story. It's more believable. Now, let's say you came tonight and everyone said, that happened last night as well, and you're the one schmuck who didn't have it happen to you. Now, this coming across is very believable because this is a room full of people you know and trust, and they all believe the same things. You've enhanced the believability status of the truth claim. Now, typically, as Christians, we go evangelizing solo. We hear someone saying we should tell our friends about Jesus. They think, you know what, you're right, I'm going to do it. So, okay, I'm going to tell my friends about Jesus. We go out, maybe we sign up for a book club or we join a soccer team or a cooking class. I'm going to tell these people about Jesus. I'm going to tell my work friends about Jesus. Charles, you're the one schmuck in a group of 20 who believe in the Jesus story. It might be true, but it's unbelievable. So what we need to do is merge our universes, get our friends, Christian friends, to become friends with our non-Christian friends. Typically, as Christians, we have two separate universes. We have a Christian universe and a non-Christian universe. When they go to a barbecue, we go with them to the barbecue. When these guys have a barbecue, we go with them to the barbecue as the one Christian schmuck. When these guys go to the movies, but we should merge universes. So when these guys say, hey, let's have a barbecue, you say, hey, can I bring some of my work friends along? And when these guys have a barbecue, you say, hey, can I bring some of my other friends along? And bit by bit, merge the universes so that now it's a 50-50 split. And then the believably status goes up. So I was once in an apartment, a hospital accommodation, where I was the only Christian and my three flatmates were non-Christians. But my Christian friends from church would always come out over and hang out with us in the apartment. So bit by bit, we merged the universes. So when my Christian friends went out to the movies, they invited my flatmates along. And when these guys went off to something, I said, hey, let's bring my church friends along. And after 2 years, it takes 2 years for a friendship to form, that you have enough trust of each other. After 2 years, all three flatmates started to come to church with me. And after 2 years, they all heard the gospel and they would have given their lives to Christ after 2 years, because we'd merged the universes. So there's several things that we can do. So we get our friends to become their friends. If you're at a stage of life where you can offer, where you can share accommodation, try sharing accommodation with non-Christians rather than Christians. That way your Christians come over and hang out with your Christian friends. You might be at a stage of life where you can offer accommodation. You know, the government pays for you to offer a room to an international university student. All you have to do is be able to offer meals and internet. And the government actually pay you. And then bit by bit, you know, these people will merge the universes. So that's the first point. We need to get our friends to become their friends. The second thing I want to suggest is this. We need to go to their things. Go to their things before they'll come to our things. Go to their things before they'll come to our things. I have a friend called Andrew. He often asks me to speak at these evangelistic events that he puts on. And every time I go and speak at these events, I notice Andrew has five non-Christian friends. And they're five different non-Christian friends every time. And they're happy to be there. I look at the body language and they're like, oh gosh, I can't believe we're doing this on a Friday night. They're actually happy to be there and they talk to me afterwards. They're happy. So I asked Andrew's wife, I said, how does Andrew do it? Every time we do this, he's got non-Christian friends, different non-Christian friends, happy to be here. What does he do? And the wife said, well, it's because we're always going to their things. This is what we normally do on a Friday or Saturday. We're always hanging out together. Anyway, so this is just one of many things that we do together. And that means for us then, we try to look for ways to go to what our friends have. And so they have things like, you know, their kids have a concert, go. If their kid's in a sports game, in a grand final, go and watch them in the thing. If they have something else on, go, like a birthday party or wedding, go. Drop everything and go. That becomes the priority. Just the other day on our street, one of the neighbours came to my wife and said, oh, our wedding's coming up. Someone's pulled out at the last minute. Would you like to go? And for my wife, it was a lot of work because I was out of town. She had to find a babysitter, but she went. And if you go to their things, it's easy then to invite them to your things because it's what you normally do. Because typically what we do is we try to add on an evangelistic event. And so we're told, you know, invite your friends to this. You think, oh, how am I going to get to come? And your non-Christian friends are thinking the same thing. Like, oh, here he comes. You know, he's going to invite us to one of these men's breakfasts. Oh, you think, when do men do breakfast together anyway? And you think, oh, now this is a make or break. But if this is what you normally do, it's one of many things we do together, then it's no big deal and your friendship's not on the line. A few years ago, I live in a cul-de-sac where all the neighbours, actually, we get pretty tight, we know each other. And one Christmas Eve, I said, what are you guys doing for Christmas Eve? They said, we're all going to the local Catholic church for Mass. And I said, can I come? They said, okay. So I went with them to Mass, and we're all in one car together, and we came back, and they said, well, what do you do for Christmas? I said, funny you should ask. You know, would you like to check out what we do next year for Christmas? So the next year, I said, hey, do you remember how we did Mass together last year? How about you come to my church this year for Christmas? And so they all did. The whole street came to my church for Christmas. So once again, we've been to their things. It's just a logical thing for them now to come to your things. So number two, go to their things before we invite them to come to our things. Number three, I call it the coffee, dinner, coffee, dinner, gospel sequence. Coffee, dinner, gospel sequence. What do I mean by this? Well, what has happened in Western history is this. In the 1600s, a philosopher called Immanuel Kant decided to divide everything that we know, everything that exists, into two separate realms. One was the realm, and I'll just rub this off, of what he called the noumenal, and the other was the realm of the phenomenal. So these realms exist, but we know them differently. So in the noumenal realm, he put things like God, ethics, and values. In the phenomenal realm, he put the world of facts, data, evidence, that sort of thing. All right, so he's not saying this world doesn't exist. He says we just can't access it. We don't know it, whereas this world we can easily access. So this is the world of things that you can see and touch and confirm. So this is the world where the sky is blue. This is the world where water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. Whereas this is the world saying God exists. Or let's pick it up, gambling is bad. You know, it's a value statement. And see, in this realm, you don't have arguments. The sky is blue. No, it's not. No, 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 we all can see it's blue. 1 + 1 = 2. No, it's not. No, we all know it from maths. Water boils 100 degrees Celsius. No, it doesn't. Yeah, we can all prove it for ourselves. So we don't argue. But in this world, you'll always have arguments. There is a God. No, there's not. Gambling is bad. No, it's not. And you can't prove your statements. And then you're always going to have arguments. And that's why we're taught in dinner parties never to talk about religion and politics, because this is the phenomenal realm. Instead, we always talk about the weather, what books you're reading, and what you did on the weekend, because these are safe. How was your weekend? I had a picnic. No, you didn't. No, no, no. You won't have fights over that. What book are you reading? I'm reading this. No, you're not. So it's very safe. And so what's happened is from this, we divide the whole world into the secular and the sacred, the public and the private. So if you want to talk about God and ethics, that's fine. Do it in the privacy of your own home where no one gets hurt. But if you want to talk about these things, that these are safe for public sphere, like schools and the main street. But if you want to talk about God, do that in the privacy of your own home by yourself, because no one's going to get hurt. But you do it in a group, someone's going to get hurt. And this is a Western hang-up. The rest of the world, the non-Western world, doesn't have this hang-up. This is why when you go to the Asian greengrocer or Asian restaurant, they have a shrine in public. They're not feeling this public-private dichotomy that we are. This is why if you catch a taxi with a Muslim driver, you can ask them about God and they're happy to talk about it. They don't go, oh, dude, you're violating my public-private sacred secular divide. There's only a Western thing. Whereas we have this hang-up. So if I said, hey, let's do this, let's have a prayer meeting tonight, but rather than do it here, let's go to the main street of Perth tonight on a Friday night and have a prayer meeting on the main street. Who wants to come? We'd all be a bit awkward because, dude, that's something we're doing in private, in a sacred space, like a church, but not the main street of Perth. That's public. Now, what that means is Australia, whether we like it or not, rightly or wrongly, is an unofficial closed country. You're not meant to talk about God in public. And there are official closed countries where you can't talk about God in public. But we're an unofficial, de facto closed country where we can't talk about God in public. And it means our friends are uncomfortable talking about God in public as well. We might be, but so are our friends. So what I try to do is work on the coffee, dinner, gospel sequence. Invite them for a coffee first. Coffee is safe. Coffee is in public space. You're in a coffee shop. It's only going to be a 10-minute commitment. It's a commitment of minutes. And even that's hard enough to pull off now, but that's what you work on. So say, hey, let's do coffee, let's do coffee, let's do coffee. Eventually, you finally do coffee together. Do that once or twice. Say, let's do dinner together. Now, dinner, you're slowly moving into private space because it's going to be in your home. It's going to be now maybe 1 or 2 hours rather than 10 minutes. Here, when you're in a coffee shop, you're going to be talking about facts, data, and evidence. Hey, boy, how about that weather? How about them Bulldogs on the weekend? What did you do on the weekend? What books are you reading? But when you start doing dinner and you're in private space, bit by bit, people open up and start talking about values and worldview issues. Where are you going to send your kids to school? How do you want to raise your kids? Are you going to get your kids baptized or not? So slowly you're talking to worldview sort of topics. So I call it the coffee dinner gospel sequence. We're on a street right now where we work very hard on that. And so front lawn is public space. Backyard is private space. So on a Friday, you go around with some beers or bottles of wine, say, hey, guys, it's Friday drinks. So you meet people on the front lawn. And while you're having drinks on the front lawn on a Friday, hey, you know, what do you reckon? Let's get some pizzas. Let's come out to the back. So slowly you're wooing them from public space, front lawn, to backyard space, and do that often enough, people get comfortable coming to private space with you. My wife right now is at a stage of life where her non-Christian friends have just exploded in number because we have young kids. So we're making non-Christian friends from school, from swimming lessons, from AFL lessons, AFL games. And my wife also runs a kids' time. And we're thinking, which one has been the most effective one? Well, swimming lessons has hardly been effective because we're always in public space at the swimming pool and it's loud. AFL, actually, that's becoming quite fruitful because after AFL, we're inviting people back to our place for a barbecue. School is working, but the one that's worked the best is the kids' time. She runs a play group in the church on a Tuesday morning, and when it's over, she says, hey, what do you reckon? Come back to my place for lunch. So she gets them from the church back to our place for lunch, and they're really enjoying private space, often come back from work and they're still there. They've been there. And so out of the kids' time ministry, we've had several mothers going to church, and one or two are, I think, are really close to converting right now, if not already. But I think it's because of this coffee dinner gospel sequence. You've got to get people into private space. So that was point number three. Point number four is learn to listen to their story first. So number four, listen to their story. What often happens to me is I might be at a party, I meet someone, you know, the music's going dum, 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 dum. And so you go, hey, what do you do for work? And they go, I'm an engineer. And they go, what do you do for work? I work with City Bible Forum. Quiet. And they, oh, see, what's just happened? We were in safe space. We're in phenomenal safe talk. What do you do for work? I'm an engineer. No, you're not. No, this is safe. But what do you do for work? I work for City Bible Forum. Just like that, we've been dragged kicking and screaming into the sacred noumenal realm way before we were ready for it in the relationship. We haven't done the coffee dinner thing, but now we're in here. And now we're awkward. Okay, oh gosh, it was way too early in the relationship. And so now you can say, you could try retreat, like, hey, how about the weather? Okay, whoo, that got us back into this one. But you think, no, hang on. 2 out of 3, maybe even 4 out of 5 Australians still on survey data say they believe in a supernatural spiritual world. They believe in a supernatural God. They believe in life after death in some form. None of us have been allowed to talk about it because we're in an unofficial closed country. This has affected not just Christians, but everyone. Everyone's too scared to talk about their belief. So then I give them permission. Hey, we came here way too early, but I'm going to give you permission to stay if you want to. So I put a feeder question out like, do you have a faith? And it's going to give them permission to stay here if they want to. Another one I saw a pastor use is, do you pray? And that's an interesting one. And I remember seeing this waiter being really awkward. Oh, I don't, but I know I should. Like that was his response. Well, wow, he's become really defensive for not praying. And he's not a Christian. This is a funny world we're living in. Spiritual, but not Christian, that sort of thing. And so I say, do you have a faith? And now when they open up, I'm trying to do three things. I'm trying to hear what they say. I'm trying to understand. And I'm trying to feel what they say. So three things. So at one time, the lady said, yeah, I'm a Buddhist. I go, wow, you're a Buddhist. Tell me about it. And let's face it, we know nothing about Buddhism. What they read in the textbooks is not what's happening in the real world in Buddhism. You're a Buddhist. Tell me about it. Were you always a Buddhist? How did you become a Buddhist? How does this work? How do you pray? How do you go to a temple? What happens in the temple? Is your husband a Buddhist? And I wasn't always a Buddhist. Well, how did you convert into Buddhism? So you're trying to get them to talk as long as you possible so they feel heard, understood, and even empathize with them. So you're not trying to come back, oh boy, Buddhism, what? Okay, this is what I learned in Bible college, this is why it's wrong, oh, wait for breaking the conversation and I'm going to show her why she's wrong. No. Hear, understand, and feel. That's all you're doing. And even then, atheist, I don't believe in a God, that's a faith-based position too. Wow, you're an atheist. Tell me about that. Were you always an atheist? And they might say, No, I grew up in an atheist family. Not that that makes me an atheist, but I had to make a decision for myself. So at the age of 16, you know. And then you realize, wow, it's just much of a faith-based story. It's a Christian story. All right, so you listen to their story so they feel heard, understood, and that you feel the emotions and why they would do that. So often we don't understand why people believe what they believe, but we need to learn to understand why. There must be some need this is fulfilling. Like, what are the emotions behind it, as well as what are the reasons behind it? And then if you ask someone how their weekend was, sooner or later they're going to ask you how your weekend was. And if you ask someone, tell me about your faith, sooner or later they're going to ask the same question, what, tell me about your faith. If you let them go for 1 minute, they'll let you go for 1 minute. If you let you go and go for 10 minutes, they might give you 10 minutes. So the whole name of the game is trying to get them to go as long as possible. So then they will reciprocate and give you a proportional amount of time. I had to give this same talk in Adelaide for City Bible Forum last year. I'm actually a loud introvert, all right? I actually prefer alone time. So I'm good in public, but I pay the price, so I just need some alone time to charge for it and to recharge afterwards. And that day it was like, go, 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 go. It was a million miles an hour. I jump in a plane, I think, oh my gosh, you know, it's 5 o'clock in just 2 hours' time. I'm in front of 200 people giving this talk. Okay, I'm sitting on the plane. But before I get the earphones in, the international symbol for do not talk to me, the guy next to me goes, oh, why are you going to Adelaide? I think, I can't believe this. I said, oh, I'm going to give a talk. And he goes, oh, I just gave a talk. I said, oh, what did you talk on? I said, well, he said, I had to speak to doctors on the physics of radiology. I thought, oh, I can't believe it. I did that exam 20 years ago. Now we have something in common. So he goes, well, why are you? What's your talk on? I think, oh, I can't believe this is happening. I work for City Bible Forum. I give talks from the Bible, Christian talks from the Bible. And I thought, I'm just about to give a talk in front of 200 people on what to do when this happens. So I said, oh, okay. Do you have a faith? And he said, well, yes. I'm from South Africa. I explored Christianity as a teenager. I read the Bible, and that's when I realized Christianity was a front for hate crimes against gays. I thought, wow, tell me about it. Tell me about this journey of yours. So I got him talking, monologuing for maybe an hour. I got him, and he raised all his objections against Christianity, the gay issues. All religions are the same, the faith and science problems. I got him going for 1 hour. And then there was a pause in the conversation when he just couldn't talk any longer. And I said, so, this is what I'm hearing you saying. So I repeated back to him, I'm hearing this is what you've said. These are your objections against Christianity. This is why you feel this way. Do you want me to respond? He goes, yes. And we had half an hour left on the flight, and he gave me a half-hour monologue because of that. And then when we landed, you know, of course I didn't convert, and this is just one of many, you know, pegs in the ladder. He thanked me, and we swapped details in case he wanted to continue the conversation. And he said, that made the flight go so quickly. And I think, oh, not for me, it did it. Not for me, it did it. All right, so listen to their story first. And then at least you know where they're coming from. You know, do they believe in a God? Do they not believe in God? Are they angry? Are they sympathetic? And then five, learn to tell our story. I used to teach at a Bible college, and often we'll go on college missions to churches and evangelistic events. And one thing they often get students to do is to tell their testimony, their story. And the testimonies, I used to joke, would sound so similar. You know, it was almost like if a student forgot their testimony, you could go, oh, I forgot my testimony. Can I borrow yours and read yours tonight? And they're almost interchangeable. It was always, you know, I grew up in a Christian family. Not that that makes me a Christian, but at some stage I had to make a decision for myself and I had to own it, and not that that makes it easy. And then, wow, it's so generic. So what we need to do is learn to tell our story. It's our story. So it's yours, it's real, it's personal, it's got examples, it's got real life events in your story. And to learn to tell a story is we need to use a storytelling grid, and all storytellers have a storytelling grid. And it's basically the Greek rule of threes. So there's an intro where you meet the characters and you define the mission. So what is the mission? Then there's a body where the mission plays out. There's usually a bridge moment where you sum up the events before and then you launch into the climax, which has the resolution. And then there's this final bit, which the French call the denouement, the unveiling, the new norm. So you began with original norm, normal, but now you have a new norm, this your new resting state. So think Christian music first. If you want to understand rule of threes, Christian music, intro is verse one, verse two, then body is chorus, verse, chorus. And then this bridge moment, hold it back, work 'em, work 'em, work 'em, work 'em, work 'em, work 'em, work 'em. And then chorus, 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 chorus. And then denouement is, you know, the worship leader, then praise or something like that. And that's your little denouement. Romantic comedy, intro, meet the characters, boy meets girl, girl meets boy, define the mission. They need to fall in love. And bit by bit, they come closer, closer. Ah, boy loses girl at that moment. Then the bridge moment where you sum up all that's gone before, that's a little montage, you know, praise, but do I love her? Do I not? Do I not? Do I love her? And then there's, yes, I do, yes, I do, yes, I do. And so now you got to climb a mountain, swim an ocean, catch a train, get the girl. And then usually there's this little scene where they talk about, oh, now we're a couple, you know, this is the new norm. James Bond, meet the characters. James Bond, bad guy, there's a chase. They catch him. Oh, there's a mission. There's a bigger bad guy out there trying to take over the world. Bit by bit, you get closer. Oh, you get captured. And that allows the bridge moment where you sum up all that's gone before. The bad guy monologues. That's the bridge moment. And then now they have to fix up everything. Usually they blow up the lair. You know, in Hollywood, everything's resolved by an explosion that blows up everything. And no loose ends if everything blows up. And then there's a final scene, James and the girl together. Sports movies, you meet the team, they're lovable losers. Oh, you know what, there's a tournament somewhere, now we have a mission. And then they get the team together. Oh, there's this moment, we can't do it, no, we're not good enough. Yes, we are, yes, we are. So training montage, you know, they get ready. And then ding, 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 the game starts. And even that's a rule of threes, they're up. They're down, and oh, they win. They score the winning goal right at the moment, last moment. All right, so even the Bible has it. So in other words, we can't tell events. There's a difference between events, which are things that happen, and stories. You need a storytelling grid to turn events into a story. So even Jesus in the synoptics, Jesus is born. He gets baptized. This is the moment here. Defines the mission, and so he's on his way to Jerusalem. Enters Jerusalem, has a Garden of Gethsemane moment. You know, do I really want to do this? Oh, yes, I do, I do, I do. And then, you know, you have the climactic scene, the resolutions, the death on the cross, and there's a little denouement where he sees his disciples again. So even that's a little storytelling grid, and John uses a slightly different one. Okay, so what we need to do is learn who are we? We all are different, we're unique, We're wired in a certain way, and we all have our own personal mission in life. Maybe you're a people pleaser. Maybe you're a perfectionist. Maybe you're very relational. Maybe you're like someone who I know who was adopted, so he's always looking for belonging, looking for a family. Maybe you never had a dad who says, "You're my son and I'm proud of you," so you're always looking for a father figure. So when I get my Bible college students to do this, they spend an hour on this. They're just looking at a blank page going, "Who am I? Who am I?" And it's not as easy as you think. Who are you? And you can have multiple personas for different audiences. So, it's, you know, Jesus in the book of John is very different from the Jesus of Mark. Your Facebook profile is very different from your CV profile. So it's the same you. You're not lying. You're just emphasizing a different part of you. But which part are you going to emphasize here? Your mission? How have you tried to achieve this mission? And then finally, there's this bridge moment, and this is when you can reveal the gospel. That's when I realized it was Jesus I was looking for. And just in all the wrong places, it's Jesus I was looking for. So I gave my life to Jesus, and this is what life looks like now. So for someone like me, you could say, you know, I'm Asian. I'm a high achiever. I was a firstborn son. My whole life, I wanted to be a doctor. Because for the Asians, that is it. That proves you've won the trophy, you've won the award. My dad's a doctor. I'll get my parents' approval. I'll get everyone's approval. So my whole life, I'm studying hard. And I get into medicine. But, you know, it's not the trouble being a high achiever. This is when you show them this is the but moment. But as a high achiever, actually, there's always another mountain to climb. There's always someone more successful than you. You remember your mistakes more than your successes. And then I'll give examples of what that looks like in my life. And that's when I realize it's Jesus. Like, I grew up in a Christian family. So I got the whole bit about Jesus died for me. I can have my sins forgiven. I can have eternal life. But it wasn't until I was in a scripture class where we looked at the book of Romans that I said, Jesus is perfect, so I don't have to be perfect. So I don't have to keep pretending to be someone I can't be. Jesus is perfect, so I don't have to be perfect. God accepts me just for who I am because of Jesus. And God loves me too much to leave me the way I am. So every day is a project where he makes me more and more like Jesus. So at that moment I thought, you know, I can just be me, and God accepts me just for who I am. And I guess this came into this crisis moment in my life where I actually had a choice. Can I serve God as a doctor, which you can, or I have this opportunity to serve God by telling people about Jesus? Up until now, you know, this was everything in my life. If you're a doctor, you're important. Bank managers want to talk to you. People want to talk to you at dinner parties. If I go this way, bank managers do not want to talk to you. And no one wants to talk to you at dinner party. And I thought, no, but this is all right. All right, because I'm comfortable in who I am. I don't need the praise of other people. Jesus is perfect, so I don't have to be perfect. So I was able then to switch from medicine into this, a life where I tell people about Jesus. And then maybe you could just do something there. But anyway, can you see how that sounds different from the, I grew up in a Christian family. I knew Jesus for as long as I remember. So it comes more as a story, more as a drama, and something where they, and it becomes more personal. All right, so that was point, was that five? Okay, final, sixth and final point. Tell Jesus. Tell a story about Jesus. How about that? Tell a story about Jesus. Tell a story about Jesus. Right now, by now, not that it works like this every way, but this is the logic. You've heard their story. You've told your story. So the story is, you have your story, I've got my story. But you say, oh, you know what? If you really want to understand more about what it is to be a Christian, my Christian faith, let me now tell you a story about Jesus. Would you like that? And so now you can say, I've got a story about Jesus. And you just pick any story, pick your favorite story. You can simplify it, leave out details that you don't think are important, change it into your own words. That's what the translators do anyway. You know, the NIV does not read like the NLT, does not read like the ESV. So there is no official English version. You come up with your own English version. And you can just say, you know, There's a story that really speaks to me as a high achiever. And Jesus told this story. He said two guys went to a temple to pray. And they were both trying to get right with God. One guy was a high achiever. He was super religious. He said, "Dear God, look at me. I've done everything. I don't cheat on my wife. I don't cheat on my taxes. I'm generous. I give to charity. Thank you. I am who I am and not like these robbers, these cheaters, these liars, people who cheat on their wives and walk out on their children. And thank you. I'm not like this tax collector." And then Jesus and this tax collector just wouldn't even look up to God and said, "Have mercy on me because I'm a sinner." And Jesus said, this man, not the other one, but this man went home right with God. Because whoever lifts themselves up before God, God will bring down. But if you humble yourself before God, God will lift you up. So you just tell a story. Another one I really love telling is the one where the woman washes Jesus' feet with perfume in her hair. Because that sort of throws everyone. No one's quite sure what to do with that story. Another one I like to do is the wedding banquet. Another one I like is, you know, one where the workers work. Some work 12 hours, some work 6 hours, some work 1 hour. And they all get paid the same. And wow, that really throws people. And then, you know, so I'm making this sound way too mechanical because it never happens like this in real life. But if you can, what do you do after you told them the story? You think, wow, you ask them, what did you like in the story? What do you think you liked in the story? Which they can't get wrong. It's a safe question. There's no wrong answer. What questions do people have about this story? What questions do you think people will have about the story? In other words, what don't you understand? And again, there's no wrong answer. So you just leave their question hanging. You don't try to answer it because now you've become the expert that's going to shoot them down. And then you ask them, well, what do you think this story is teaching us about Jesus? And what do you think, if there's a God, what is God trying to tell you in this story? So, of course, I'm trying to make it sound way too mechanical, but this is really a safe way of presenting the gospel. Because, you know, in real life, we never really get to pull out a tract. We never get to read something to someone. But here, you're just telling a story about Jesus and hopefully getting them to talk about it. So what have I talked about tonight? Just some things that equip us. So I guess what I'm arguing for is normally we treat evangelism like a New Year's resolution to get fit. You know, we always think, oh, this year I'm going to get fit. I'm going to sign up to a gym. I'm going to get up early in the morning. I'm going to run. And so we tack on something onto our lifestyle, and it's just unsustainable. And evangelism, we often treat the same way. Oh, I've got to tell my friends about Jesus. I've got to work up the courage. I've got to look for an opportunity. Maybe our church has to put in an event. Really what we need is a lifestyle change, where the whole of lifestyle is evangelistic, and churches need to change. So all of church, even the Sunday service, is evangelistic, where we merge our universes. So tonight I've said, one, get our friends to become their friends. Two, go to their things before they come to our things. Three, try moving them into private space, coffee, dinner, gospel, front yard, backyard. Four, listen to their story first. Make them feel safe, and they heard and understood and not threatened. Tell our story and then try to tell a story from Jesus. All right, we have time for some question time. So ask me any question that you want. Yes.
Yeah, so this is what you were talking about, like asking people, like, do you have a faith?
Yes.
What about, and that kind of whole, try not to freak them out, whatever.
Yeah. Oh, okay. So that's interesting. So you'd say, wow. So a friend of mine who's a chaplain told me, just ask him, wow, you seem really angry about this. What's making you so angry? Something like that. That really disarms them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but if they stay angry, you're not going to get very far in the conversation because they're not in a conversational mood. They're in an argumentative mood. And I would try to stay away from the argument. Just a quick 1 minute side note. It's interesting, you know, there are people out there that actually spend all week wanting a fight. So from Monday, Tuesday, they're actually in a gym training for a fight. And then on Friday or Saturday night, they'll hit a bar looking for a fight. You've just gone out for dinner. And then so they look you in the eye and they go, are you looking at me? And apparently by then they're in launch sequence and they've been training all week for this moment. And you're thinking, I came here for a dinner. You don't even realise you're 5 seconds away from a full-on fist fight. and then now you're put in fight or no, you're put in fright or flight. They're put in fight. And I have fun with these. Some people just seem a bit too ready for an argument. They've been training, wanting to take down a Christian, and I think that is there's no point. And they're completely in the wrong mood. They're wanting a fight. They're not wanting a conversation. Yes. Yeah. Oh, well. So this is a real situation or hypothetical? Okay. There's so many directions we can go. So I used to teach ethics. I actually used to get a lot of Christians who came out of the gay lifestyle teaching on this. And they said, you know, they give lots of things we can take away. One is we just talk to them like we talk to any non-Christian. Because all of us aren't living God's way, both Christians and non-Christians. So we don't need to focus on the fact that they're homosexual. Because all of us are broken. Some of us are we're jealous, or we're greedy, or we're envious, or there are people with heterosexual sins. So that's one way of pointing it out. Other people say, you know, God isn't trying to make gay people straight. This is not what it's about. He wants gay and straight people just to know and love Him. This actually isn't about making gay people straight. That's not what we're trying to do. So that's another way. Another way is where you and I disagree actually isn't over the gay issue. It's not over the gay issue. Where you and I disagree is whether there's a God that we believe loves us enough that I'm just going to have to trust Him on this one. Because there are many things about a loving partner that we're not going to understand, but if we trust them, we don't try to change them. We somehow, especially if it's God, say, you know, somehow you know me better than I know myself, and I'm going to have to trust you on this one. Another way of going in is, this is really hard to understand on the outside, but when you're on the inside, a lot of this will make a lot more sense. So maybe on the outside right now, this seems harsh and cruel, and not to belittle, not to trivialize this, but I remember before I had kids, I spent 10 years before I had kids. Because I actually thought, I don't see how having children will bring any joy. I really thought, it looks hard work. I'm looking at my friends, they're flustered, they're changing nappies. Everyone used to say, you don't get it. It's different when you have a child and they're one of your own. I said, no, I don't accept that. Poo is poo, you know, like that. and then I had a child. I thought, you're right, it is different once you have a child. It is different. So imagine missing out on some preconceived notion. I said, you know, we're all broken. None of us live in God's way, gay or straight. But this will be very different on the inside. Once you get to know and trust this God, you're going to see this is very different on the inside. And imagine missing out on this God for some preconceived barrier that really isn't a problem once we're on the inside. It really is. And whether I said the right thing or the wrong thing, I don't know. But I spoke evangelistically one night and a gay couple came and they said, you know what? We want to become Christians. But what does that mean? We're committed to each other. And I said, wow, I don't know. Like, it's almost like what you do with the Africans who are polygamous and now they become Christians. It's almost like you've gone so far and, you know, they've adopted an embryo and this is really messy. I said, I don't know. Like, really, I don't know. Like, this is way beyond my knowledge or experience. But, you know, it will be different once you make the decision. So why don't you just make the decision first and see where God leads you? Because we all start off broken. So Christianity is not about fix yourself up and then accept God. It's all about accept God and then He'll show you the next step forward. So I think just wrong preconceived ideas of what it means to be a Christian. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yes, Tim.
In my experience, so I'm 37, I've got two young kids, it's really hard to make friends.
Yeah.
Like the dads at my school,
yeah.
it's like harassment to get them to just hang out with you.
Yeah.
And I think you So I'm just making some comments in there.
Yeah.
Keen to get your reflections. But then, if you have a church situation where you commit to take on perhaps a leadership position, and then you have a responsibility for pastoral care for Christians, it's really there's not much time left in the week.
No, yeah.
For like beers on the
yeah. Yeah. Mm. Oh, okay. So, at my church, we try to, and I'm not saying these are rules that you must stick by, but so at my church, we try to make it that there's only one extra event in the week besides the Sunday event so that we can still be with our non-Christian friends. You're right, men are very private. So I try to read a lot of books that describe, issues with men, like Stephen Bidoff, Manhood, other books. So somehow every time you're with these men, you seem to have a wisdom about what they're going through. And they go, boy, this guy seems to know a lot. Also, we tend to get together because they have our wives. So Steph, my wife, does all the hard work. So suddenly all these men are now at a barbecue because their wives or are best friends. So now we're all stuck together. But that seems to work. So what tend to work for us is Steph and I try to do date night. We have a regular babysitter once a week. And every now and then, maybe every second or third date night, we ring up one of these couples and say, hey, we're doing date night. What do you reckon? Get a babysitter and join us. We're going to do karaoke tonight. We're going to do something crazy. And they do. So we get these non-Christians to join us in karaoke. And these aren't even Asians, all right? But just something to get them out of their comfort zone and having a good time with us. And so we try to do date night. The AFL one has seemed to work quite well because we say, hey, we're out here anyway, just come back to our place for a barbecue. Yeah. We did a wine and cheese one. We said, hey, we're going to do a wine and cheese night. We got this wine expert to come. And it's almost like what a church would put on, but except you do it yourself. We say, hey, we put on this wine and cheese one. What do you reckon? Do you want to come and... I don't know. I'm just adding things to it. But you're asking more of a lifestyle question, like where do I squeeze this in? I don't know.
Well, it's that it feels like there's time pressure, but also my experience of like Australian men are roughly my age. I presume it's probably the same when you get older.
Yeah.
Probably guys just that are reciprocation.
Mm. Yeah. Well, they say if you can do an activity together, they don't want to sit together. And I agree, it's hard. It just got to be, just keep trying, keep chipping. I don't know, in AFL, what I've decided this year, it's a resolution, this year, because a friend of mine, they just finished AFL, it said their kids become 18, so they've been doing the AFL Saturday for 10 years. He said, that is your ministry. Embrace it. Because I try to fight. I just drop the kids and run and hide and read the paper so I wouldn't get roped into water duty or goal umpire duty. He said, no. If you get so involved, you become the trusted figure. He said he ended up becoming like de facto chaplain for all the parents on the sideline because they knew he was a Christian. And so they used to come up to him, with pastoral issues. So I thought, okay, that's what I'm going to do this year for AFL. I'm going to embrace it. I'm going to put myself on as many rosters as I can and so win the coach and the manager over so that, wow, he's a guy who's cooperative for a change and then just talk to as many of the men who are just standing by themselves and say, hey, which one's your kid? So I've started doing that this year and that seems quite natural. So again, men are shoulder to shoulder looking at something rather than looking at the ice. As long as you're looking at a ball, it's all right. I'm moving. I don't know.
I just have an idea. We do park
run. Yeah, that's right. And say, come back to my place for a coffee. Because you always end up with a coffee after park run, don't you? So I did that. I did park run for a little while and we go to a coffee shop and that was fun. And I go, I say, I've just read a book on midlife crises. Did you know that the three things men feel trapped by at the age of 40 is their aging bodies, their wife and kids, and their job. They feel their job is going nowhere. And they just sit there, they just go silent and go, wow. And I go, because you become this all-knowing seer, this sage at this point. Yeah. And because one of the non-Christian dads on our street said, I don't know what it's about, because there are one or two other Christians on our street, they say, you guys just seem to know a bit more about how to do life. And all those is, yeah, you just got to drop these one or two pearls every. So I found that seems to work. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
Pressuring people into hearing your opinion.
Yep, yep, yep. Yeah, there's no right or wrong answer, case by case. I'm actually a very gentle, softly approach. And I really think it's in the relationships. Because we all think it's about, I've got to present an argument, tell them facts, evidence, and data. But as we saw from the UFO story, that actually is very unconvincing and compelling belief. It more is having a trusted friend, because if this is what my trusted friend believes, it becomes more believable. So I really think it's much more about becoming a trusted friend. So I put a lot of work in that. And I wouldn't be so harsh on yourself by, oh, this is taking a long time. Because long-term relationships, I think, take longer because there's more at stake. Whereas short-term relationships, if I'm not going to see this person again, it's almost like that frees you up to talk about things because now you're this safe stranger I can open up to. So what's really interesting is there are three layers to ourselves and three layers to conversation. The first one is interests. The next one is values. And the final one is worldview. All right, so interest is where you talk about, you know, what did you do in the weekend? I went on a park run. And so that's safe. And it's about recognizing where you are in the conversation. And after a while, you might probe. You might say, how come you like park runs so much? Why do you always want to do 5K runs on a Saturday? To answer that, they're going to reveal a bit of values now. I just think it's important to stay fit. You know, I don't like how out of shape I'm becoming. I want to get fit. You just let me feel hurt. And then if you probe, so, well, what is about health that got you so worried or interested? And then to answer that, they're going to have to give a bit of worldview. So it's about feeling. And chaplains tell me, so you can either try to feel and using gentle questions, nudge, and if they don't answer, that's them saying, I want to stay here. You know, I'm not going to come here. I just want to stay here right now. And that's fine. So you probe, but they're not going to let you go further in. Chaplains also say it's all about being a good listener, that people actually give you permission to proceed, and they usually give you one, two, maybe three chances to keep going in. And so if you don't pick up on the first hint, they drop it again. You don't pick that up. They drop it again. And if you don't pick up on the third hint, then they just close. Okay, you're not coming in with me. So it could be a little thing like, my kid's struggling in school a lot. You think, okay, so that's the hint. That's a hint to go further. So, what do you mean by that? So then they're coming in. So you got to pick up on the hint. My mother died this year. So someone did that to me, you know, a little while ago. My mother died this year. Okay, they're saying, I want you to come in. I want you to come in. I don't want to talk about the weather anymore. I want to come in a bit more. So it's a bit more about listening. And again, don't be hard on yourself. This is a long-term relationship because they don't want to sacrifice the friendship. So they're taking their time as well. Whereas if you're meeting a stranger, so I was once on a college mission on the way to a regional part of New South Wales. We stopped somewhere to pick up petrol. And I was with this guy who'd been this gun missionary in China. And this guy is just amazing with one-on-one evangelism. So we go fill up petrol. The lady says, what are you here for? Where are you guys going? So that's a safe question. And he says, we're on a Bible college mission. We're going to go to church in, you know, this city. Wow, you're into values now. You mentioned Bible. And then she just goes, do you go to church? And she goes, yeah, I used to go to church. Wow, what happened? My son died in a tractor accident. The church wasn't very good about it. And so she goes, wow, so you're very hurt by the church, aren't you? She goes, yeah. And he goes, would you like us to pray for you right now? She goes, yes, I would too. So he'd gone in like that, like in a two-minute conversation at a cashier. But again, you think, well, there was nothing at stake. She's not going to see us again. We're not going to see her. And that's why she's happy to let you in that quickly. But when you talk about friends and family, it's okay to understand we're in a longer dance. There's more at stake. And someone said, what we can do is pray. You know, Jesus has that saying, the harvest is plentiful. And he says, pray. Rather than said, go. Jesus, pray that God sends harvesters. So especially with family, an older family where there's a hierarchical power asymmetry, pray that God sends Christian friends to my parents or sends more Christian friends to my friends who I'm trying to evangelize. So I shouldn't be doing this solo. Pray that God sends more Christians in here. Okay, one last question, Steve.
You mentioned the importance of the private world.
Mm.
And for us, my agent Les, it's harder to buy a private space.
Yeah.
In terms of real estate and so on.
Yeah.
Do you have any thoughts on that? And should we, what should we be doing as a church to be thinking through that? Because on one level, we don't want people to be, living their whole life towards a mortgage.
Yeah. Yeah, well, there are other avenues of private space, like the back table in a coffee shop or the back table in a restaurant, that sort of stuff. So that's pretty safe. So there are other avenues of private space. Obviously, it's a luxury. Often it seems to imply a home, but, there are other ways to make it work. But it does mean when we choose where to live, that may be a factor, but maybe a factor that's out of our financial control. But what's interesting, the Bible actually, now I'm noticing this more and more, has hospitality as a big thing in the New Testament. And I used to think, that just meant tea and bickies. But now I'm realizing, hospitality is about getting people in private space. Without this, the environment for gospel discussions couldn't happen. And most of us aren't gifted in hospitality. I'm not, but my wife is. But it's just, this is an amazing gifting. So I don't know. Somehow we have the gifting of hospitality. We'll find a way to find private spaces or create private spaces.
Yeah. Thanks, Sam.
No worries.